From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And I'm going to withhold judgment based upon what the board does.
Today we'll look at that board, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, 18 members all appointed by the Texas governor. We'll also hear from activists.
But we are going to stop it. But it doesn't mean that we're not terrified, that I'm not, you know, I wasn't down on the floor crying last night, but I'm up. And I'm moving again because I'm human and I'm going to stay human.
Today, the case of Gary Graham in the 11th hour. Also, an explosive expose on how the U.S. and U.N. are funding terror in Kosovo. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we're going to continue our watch of the Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa case. Perhaps no other case has focused attention on the death penalty more than this. He's just hours away from execution in Huntsville, Texas. Graham was convicted and sentenced to death for the 1981 fatal shooting of 53-year-old Bobby Lambert during an attempted nighttime robbery in the parking lot of a Safeway supermarket. Graham's conviction turned on a single eyewitness with no supporting evidence. Two other eyewitnesses who say Graham was not the killer were never called to testify. For 19 years, Graham's maintained his innocence. There have been widespread protests across the country demanding that Governor George Bush stop the execution. Activists have also been following Bush around on the campaign trail, in some cases disrupting his speeches. Here is what happened during one Bush campaign speech earlier this week. Governor Bush has continued to defend his death penalty as he travels around the country.
I'm going to analyze each case when it comes across my desk, Todd. I'm going to look at the innocence and guilt of each person and whether or not the person has had full access to the courts. And as far as I'm concerned, there has not been one innocent person executed since I've been the governor.
We go now right to Texas, and we are joined by Ashanti Chemaranga, who is on her way to see Shaka Sankofa. She has been one of his attorneys for many years.
I'm on the way to the prison, driving on the highway. I can visit heading toward Huntsville, which is about an hour and a half out of Houston, going north. I'm going to the prison to see Shaka Sankofa. He's been moved to the death chamber, which is located in a prison called the Walls Unit. It's kind of in a city area in Huntsville. It's about 100 miles from the prison that he's, Livingston, where he's actually confined on a day-to-day basis.
He said he was not going to cooperate?
He did resist, and in fact, it was reported yesterday. The media, the warden asked me before I left for my night phone number, curious about why he was calling, but hopeful that maybe he had some indication of a stay. I gave it to him and left Shaka at 5 o'clock. I'd been with him from around 10 to 5, myself and other members of his family, and Reverend Herbert Daughtry from New York. Reverend Jesse Jackson had been in the day before with Bianca Jagger. And I left him at 5, and by the time I got home at 7, I had a message that he had been moved. We're assuming that they may not have even given him any notice of that, but probably just took him straight from the visiting area. He did, on television, they reported that he did resist, and he had certainly indicated to me that he knew their plan was to move him. He didn't know exactly when, and that he would be resisting, and that if they moved him, I could assume that he had been gassed and or beaten. I don't know exactly what happened.
How does one resist?
Pardon me?
How would Gary Graham resist?
Well, his spirits are strong. This is one of the most and strongest, incredible individuals. This is one of the reasons why they're so intent on carrying forth this execution. They understand clearly that, kind of like a George Jackson, like a Malcolm X, this man has managed to internalize and strengthen, just a lot like steel, I've never met anybody as strong. He is, yesterday we spent the conversation talking about the community and politics and revolutionary movements. He read to me about the revolutionary individual, a particular piece that he was quite fond of, and talked about the United Nations petition filed in his case. He indicated to me that he felt confident that this racist system, as he said, would not be able to rob the people of justice in this case. He was fighting for his children, his grandchildren, for the community, his friend.
Ashanti Chimurenga, you've been through this before, up to this point, with Shaka Sankofa.
Well, yes, I've been involved in this since 1993 when we first learned of the new evidence in his case, and he faced three execution dates, and three serious execution dates in a three-month period, coming within hours each time, and that was in April 93, June 93, and August 93, and each time we turned the corner into the actual day before we got a stay. Each time I was on the same road at the same time, heading to the prison of being at 8 o'clock and spend the hours with them until we learned the news. In August 93, we actually went to 7 o'clock at night, and we went from the one prison over to the walls unit. And it was a horrifying experience hearing them ask about his last meal and all of that. I have sat in the visiting room before and heard the wardens and other people ask prisoners what should be done with their body and what did they want for their last meal. And so yesterday his sister, his daughter, his stepmother, and myself were all subjected to that question. Even though I told the warden that I would take care of it, he still, as soon as his daughter came in, and she's 5 months pregnant, and his stepmother, pulled him off in the corner and started talking about, you know, this. So it's a vicious system here. The Houston papers and television stations really are very biased, perpetuating a number of lies, that there was some kind of rape and rape conviction lie, that Shaka Sankofa made some statement about he would hurt someone lie. In fact, that was some concocted statement that came up similar to how they made up the statement in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. If in fact Shaka Sankofa made some threatening remark about killing someone in 1981, it would have certainly surfaced in court records prior to that. And in his 1987, the only little time he ever had a hearing in 1987. So on the television stations here, you know, they're talking about it's time for him to meet his executioner and really, you know, perpetuating his rabid. It's kind of like vicious dogs out here.
Do you think are the chances at this point of Shaka Sankofa getting a reprieve?
Well, I think that they're still very good. I mean, I think that, you know, this is a system that is ignorant and mean without real teeth. You know, we've come together, grassroots, academics, jurists. The letter Amnesty presented has signatures as wide and varied as a Pat Robertson, a conservative Republican, to the president of the European Union, to Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins. And that's not counting all of the people in the streets, the grassroots people, and folks like myself. Never before have we had this kind of concerted effort. So I'm not afraid because the state is intent on killing him. It's always been a battle of strength and will. And so we're determined. And we may not get the stay to 559, but we're going to get a stay of execution. And we just need to think about what it must cost him to sit there in this situation. It's a countdown. And in fact, we understand that we've been informed very informally that action might be taken very late. And Governor Bush only stopped the execution of Ricky McGinn at 15 minutes before the execution. You know, a prisoner was taken off of the gurney. So we're going to stop the execution. If we continue to have faith, if we start to think we won't, then we won't. But we are going to stop it. But it doesn't mean that we're not terrified, that I'm not, you know, I wasn't down on the floor crying last night, but I'm up, and I'm moving again because I'm human, and I'm going to stay human. because that's the only answer to this kind of barbaric monster. Yes, I'm frightened about them killing an innocent human being who I've come to know, love, and respect, a black man. But we're going to keep fighting, and we're strong enough to overcome this terror, and we will.
Has the Clinton administration weighed in any way? The Vice President Gore, who's running against Bush, has he made any comments on this case? We called yesterday, and they said they had never been asked before about it.
Well, let me say that we know that the Congressional Black Caucus has been speaking on the floor, sent letters out to various administrations. We know that Vice President Al Gore came out yesterday on television and talked about his support for the death penalty, which clearly in the face of the debate around this issue was an attempt, I think, to, you know, at least vacillate and, you know, equivocate on the issue. And maybe tomorrow when we have this day or not, then he'll want to put some teeth in. I guess he's afraid of the people who want the death penalty. We need to hear from. But no, we have been in contact with the Washington administration from the congressional offices. Yesterday, congressional representatives spoke live from the floor. They've written letters to Janet Reno with signatures. All members of the Congressional Black Caucus signed on to a letter to Governor George Bush and the chairman of the Board of Pardons and Parole. We know that congressional representatives have been in contact with the office of President Clinton. And so this is a failure on the part of both the state and federal administration. We continue to talk about George Bush. This is in his hands as a matter of last resort. This is about the U.S. Supreme Court. This is about the federal courts. This is about President Clinton. He passed the he pushed through the act that has us sitting here right now waiting for this lethal injection that sticks, and that was the Anti-Terrorist and Effective Death Penalty Act, which limits unconstitutionally individuals' rights to present claims in courts, even though statistics in the Columbia study and other data demonstrated that there are meritorious appeals raised by death prisoners, either as to the conviction or the sentence, that are only caught on appeal. But they want to hasten these people to their death, and that's the trap that we got caught in. So this is not Republicans versus Democrats. This is wrong versus wrong.
Ashanti Chimurenga, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, we're going to talk about in a minute with Alan Berlow, a freelance reporter who did a piece looking at this body. Do you think they'll meet in person? Is it possible it's illegal that they don't meet in person when they make decisions about life and death like this?
Well, clearly there's a number of constitutional flaws in the administration of the Texas Board of Pardons and Parole. This is really a dysfunctional, almost non-existent body that attempts to deal with serious complex clemency petitions by faxing papers to each other over a fax machine as they sit in 18 spread over the state, 18 different directions. They do not meet as a body. They do not consider as a body. They do not present the attorneys for an opportunity to come in and argue the matter. Often they will accept papers from the state that has exaggerated and just plain out lies and not share those papers with the prisoner or the prisoner's lawyer so that they can challenge and or, you know, clarify any matters. They do not give any decisions. And we understand that the Board of the Pardons and Parole yesterday, now this I did not hear, but it was reported, stated on television, that some members of the board thought that Gary Graham was innocent, that he personally thought that Gary Graham was guilty. It takes 10 votes out of the 18 members for us to get clemency or reprieve. So we need the 10 votes. But we are also going back to the United States Supreme Court, and we're also going back to the state appellate court. And I think that we need to keep a focus on that because the courts should have addressed this matter. And clearly the U.S. Supreme Court, if none of the other courts should have, when we have been up to them and they just recently, and they held the case for a year, granted relief, especially since the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit acknowledged that there was a substantial body of evidence of innocence that should be heard. That was in 1997, 1998. They pushed us back into the state court, and then when we attempted to come back, because the state courts continued to be unjust and refused to open the court doors to hear this overwhelming evidence of innocence, eyewitnesses who are emphatic that it was not Gary Graham in 1981 that killed Bobby Lambert, alibi witnesses, ballistics report that shows that the gun that they showed to the prosecutors was, that showed to the jury was not the gun. Three jurors have now, who from the 1981 trial, have come forward and stated that they do not think that Gary Graham received a fair trial. They regret their verdict. They would have changed their verdict and not have voted that way had they been aware of the information. The startling information about Ron Mock, the court-appointed system, and his just utter failure, negligence, and callous indifference to this matter.
Ashanti Chimurenga, I want to thank you for being with us, and drive carefully as you make your way to the prison
this day.
Either could be the last day of Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa's life, or could be the beginning of a path that might lead to a new trial.
Yes. Thank you so much, Amy.
Ashanti Chimurenga, who is now going into the prison to see Shaka Sankofa. She has been one of his attorneys for many years. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Texas Governor George Bush remains defiant against calls for reprieve and has said the decision is not up to him.
The governor's powers are really dependent upon what the Board of Pardon and Parole does. Minerva, the board has yet to meet. They'll be making their decision, or they'll be sending in their ballots tomorrow. And I'm going to withhold judgment based upon what the board does.
And today we're going to look at that Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, which at noon Texas time is expected to give their recommendation on whether or not to go ahead with the Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa execution. The board can recommend the governor commute the sentence, recommend a reprieve, a delay, or a hearing, or not recommend commutation. Today, we're going to look at the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles with Alan Berlow, an independent journalist who recently wrote an article in the American Prospect on George Bush and the death penalty called Lethal Injustice. And it documents the record of this Texas board. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan Berlow.
Good morning.
Can you lay out for us what this board is?
Yeah, in brief, it's constituted of 18 members appointed by the governor. In Bush's case, all 18 have been appointed by him for six-year terms. And the board presides over thousands of parole decisions. They handle about 1,000 parole decisions a month in addition to the death penalty cases. If you're interested in specifics on members of the board, five of the members previously worked for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. It's been described as a collection of, you know, people from different sectors. It's racially mixed. It's supposed to be represent a cross-section of society. I think that would probably be an overstatement. It's at least three of the members that I identified at the time I wrote the story have given contributions to Bush. I see them largely as Bush loyalists, which isn't to say that they don't make some decisions that differ from the governor, but they're largely a group of loyal Republicans who the governor has appointed.
All 18 members of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles were appointed by George Bush?
That's right.
We're going to continue with this discussion after we break for stations to identify themselves. And then we're going to Maryland, to Kirk Bloodsworth. He is the first person who was on death row to be exonerated by DNA evidence. After that, we'll bring you an explosive exposé on how the United States and the United Nations are funding terror in Kosovo. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And by the way, folks, you can make your views heard in these last hours as the Board of Paroles makes its decision. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles number is 512-406-5852. That's 512-406-5852. We'll be back in a minute. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue on the discussion of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles that will make its decision today about the Gary Graham case. We're on the line with Alan Berlow, who wrote a piece in a recent issue of American Prospect magazine on this Texas board. When Texas Governor George Bush talks about the board and says it's not up to him, it's up to them, do you think there's independence there?
Yes, there's the board is independent from the governor. I think what's untrue about what the governor states, and he stated this repeatedly, is that he suggests that he's totally at the mercy of the board, that he can't act without a recommendation of the board. That's simply not true. The governor has the power. It's largely political power as opposed to legal power, but he does have the power to order the board to conduct an investigation of a case, as they might do in the Gary Graham case if there was some question of doubt. Bush has never done that. The governor has the power to order the board to hold a hearing. The governor has never done that. This is a board that does not hold hearings. They don't meet. They don't have discussions among themselves. There was a call yesterday for such a hearing in the Graham case, and I don't know that they are not doing that today. It's an exceptional case. There's obviously been an enormous amount of publicity surrounding it, and they may be doing that today. I don't know. But when the governor says that he has no power to sway the board, he's simply incorrect.
This board that hasn't met in many years, that makes its decisions by faxes, by communications like that, but not as a group together, is that possibly illegal, as I asked Ashanti Chimurenga before?
Well, I don't think it's illegal. There was a hearing in 1998 before a Texas, he's a federal district court judge in Austin, Sam Sparks. This was in the case of Henry Falder, which is an extraordinary case in and of itself. Bush has, as you know, stated that there are two standards that he applies in death penalty cases. One is innocence. Is there any evidence of innocence? Two, is there a question as to whether the person who is to be executed had full access to the court? In the Graham case, obviously both of those issues are in play. Graham is maintaining that he was innocent. He's also maintaining that his lawyer failed to represent him, failed to put up exculpatory witnesses, eyewitnesses who said that that he was not the shooter. Now, in 1998, in the Henry Falder case, Falder was condemned to die for murdering the wife of a wealthy Texas oilman, and his prosecutor was literally hired by the victim's husband. Now, that obviously raises a question of due process. Bush didn't see fit to grant a reprieve in that case, obviously. He's never done that. But when the case came before Judge Sparks, Falder was claiming that he did not have a fair hearing before the Board of Pardons and Paroles. And Sparks, in the course of that hearing, described the way the board works. And one of the statements he made, and I'm quoting here, he says, "It's incredible testimony to me that in an 18-member board that no person has ever seen an application for clemency important enough to hold a hearing on or talk with each other about." And he pointed out that board members cast votes without reviewing files, without reading correspondence, and without providing the governor a reason for denying clemency. So Bush sits there and he says, "Well, I'm listening to the recommendations of the board." But the board is mute except to say, "Well, we recommend clemency or we don't." And what Sparks said in reference to that was, and again I'm quoting, he says, "There is nothing, absolutely nothing, that the Board of Pardons and Paroles does where any member of the public, including the governor, can find out why they did this. I find that appalling," end quote.
But Bush clearly doesn't.
No, Bush doesn't seem to find it appalling at all. In fact, he has warmly embraced the Board of Pardons and Parole and uses it as a means of distancing himself from the execution process.
In fact, you quote Bush saying that open hearings would leave them, which would leave them open to public scrutiny, quote, would only provide a chance for people to rant and rail, a chance for people to emotionalize the process beyond the questions that need to be asked.
Right, and the questions that Bush thinks need to be asked are extremely limited. I think it's interesting in that light. I mean, he says that the questions that he asks, and he's like a broken record on this, he says, I want to know if there's evidence of innocence, and I want to know if the person has had due process. But what is the standard that Bush applies? When Governor George Ryan of Illinois called for a moratorium on executions earlier this year, he said he was disturbed that 13 people had been found innocent on Illinois' death row. And he said he wanted a, quote, moral certainty that no innocent person would be executed. What is Bush's standard? Bush's standard in practice seems to be absolute proof of innocence. He needs to be shown absolutely that this is that the person who is about to be executed is innocent. Now, that's a standard that goes obviously far beyond Ryan's moral certainty. It also goes far beyond what a juror normally is asked to apply, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. If Bush were to apply a reasonable doubt standard in these cases, he would have had to grant clemency in at least a half a dozen or more cases that have come across his desk.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. If people want to read the piece you wrote in American Prospect called Lethal Injustice, is there some place they can go on the web?
Yeah, it's at the American Prospect website. I believe that's AmericanProspect.com.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Alan Berlow.
My pleasure.
As we move on now and look at another aspect of the death penalty, you may have heard yesterday Florida Governor Jeb Bush allowed the controversial execution of a murderer who thought he was Jesus last night, as his brother, Texas Governor George Bush, who, by the way, Reverend Jesse Jackson last week called Pontius Pilate, is under pressure to stop the execution of Gary Graham today. Thomas Provenzano was executed last night in Florida for killing a court bailiff in 1984. The execution came a day after Provenzano won a brief court-ordered reprieve Tuesday, 11 minutes before officials were to pump poison into him through catheters already inserted into his veins. Provenzano's sister had asked the governor in a letter to spare her brother, saying, you know that he's mentally ill, he believes he's Jesus Christ, and that he's going to be executed because people hate Jesus. But Jeb Bush responded he found no reason to alter the sentence. Meanwhile, George Bush has been under serious pressure as he campaigns in California. Throughout his visit, the state, from Palo Alto to Los Angeles, death penalty opponents have confronted Bush on the case of Gary Graham, scheduled to die at 6 o'clock today, Texas time. But he continues to tell reporters in Los Angeles that he has never convicted or had anyone killed who was innocent.
I'm going to analyze each case when it comes across my desk, Todd. I'm going to look at the innocence and guilt of each person and whether or not the person has had full access to the courts. And as far as I'm concerned, there has not been one innocent person executed since I've been the governor.
We've been looking a lot at Gary Graham's case. And by the way, you can call the governor because the hours are still ticking away. The governor's number in Texas is 512-463-2000. That's 512-463-2000. And his fax number is 512-463-1849. That's 512-463-1849. But it is not the only controversial case in Texas. In Dallas, results of genetic tests filed in a federal court yesterday raised serious questions about evidence used to condemn a man to death there. Michael Blair was convicted in 1998 of molesting and strangling a 7-year-old girl named Ashley Estelle. Results of the DNA test on hair samples used to link Blair to the crime show the hair, quote, could not have originated from Ashley Estelle, Michael Blair, or any other maternal relatives. Blair has had two stays of his execution. Well, today we're going to continue to look at the death penalty and issues of evidence and innocence. We're going to a Baltimore man who spent 9 years in prison, including two on death row, for a crime he did not commit. Kirk Bloodsworth was convicted for the 1984 sexual assault and murder of a 7-year-old girl. He was found guilty based on the testimony of 5 witnesses, but DNA tests eventually cleared him, and he was released from prison in 1993, 7 years ago next week. The governor of Maryland pardoned Bloodsworth, and the state has awarded him $300,000. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kirk Bloodsworth.
How you doing?
Well, it's good to have you with us. Tell us what happened in your case.
Well, the little girl was 9 years old at the time. I had no relationship or knew this child or been in the area or had any contact with her whatsoever. Basically, it was a composite sketch was done from the witnesses of who they saw. Nobody witnessed the crime actually happening. There was 2 little boys who said they had seen this individual, a man, 6'5", curly blonde hair, bushy mustache, tan skin, and skinny. I'm not 6 foot. I'm about 5'11¾", something like that. I have red hair. I'm a big person. I weigh over 200 and some pounds. I did at the time, and I have red hair and fair skin. So it just hinged upon what people perceived at the time. I believe that the 2 main eyewitnesses who were children themselves were fishing in a pond area in Baltimore County. They said they saw this man standing around while they were fishing, and the Dawn Hamilton, the little girl who was brutally killed, came along and eventually, supposedly, had went off into the wooded area with this person. Now, both witnesses at the time never identified me in a lineup. It was until later that they had called into the police department saying that they should have picked number 6, which was my number in the lineup. Early on, I was given a photo array. The police called the witnesses and told them that I was arrested and not to watch TV. They had all seen my picture and photograph prior to the lineups and so forth. So evidence was withheld in the case about another suspect. I can't mention their names. There was 2 individuals that were compelling. One person, whom I'll just say his name is David, was seen at a psychiatric hospital in Franklin Square Hospital in Baltimore County, Maryland, came without an appointment the day of the murder with the same type of clothing was worn, who the witnesses say was worn by this individual, with scratches on his face, perspiring, and complaining about having a problem with the little girl. This was the day of the murder, right after they think it might have took place sometime.
Did he say he was having a problem with that little girl?
No, that was never ever pinpointed. It was just a little girl. He had scratches on his face. And this was the report that was withheld from us, by the prosecution, and as well as another confidential report about another suspect early on. So in the Brady evidence, my case was overturned in the early beginning after I was convicted the first time. I had 10 eyewitnesses I was with that day, total account of my whereabouts. There was a lot of twisting and turning of statements that were made, saying that I said I did a terrible thing, and it was in reference to a statement made to my wife and I, who had just I had just left because we were having marital problems. It basically turned out that I was convicted in 1985, in March 1985, and sentenced to death of that year, and also received death and double life in the beginning, in the first case. The case was overturned. I received a new trial, was convicted again, telling everybody that I was innocent. I was not there. I did not know the child or, like I said in the early part, anything about it other than what was on TV and in the newspapers, because it was widespread publicity about the case. It happened to a little girl, and it's, you know, everybody wants somebody that could do something like that to a child caught, or anyone for that matter, but a small child like that, it's a horrific thing. And
so how did they figure it all out?
Well, it obviously they didn't until later on. What happened was I took a second trial, and I read this book going in. I have, you know, been from the early beginning in my case. Right now it'd be 17 years, I would imagine, since the crime happened and my case ensued since all this began. So it took a long time. It took 9 years, 8 years, 11 months, and 19 days to be exact.
You were the first person taken off death row because of DNA evidence?
Right. The first one ever to be sentenced to death and be under a capital sentence to be released.
Mm-hmm. And so they did a DNA test?
Yes.
They compared it to what was on the little girl?
There was a pair of panties that were found at the scene that the FBI, because of the size of the spot in 1984, they had no technology that could test anything of that nature, and it just stayed there. By the process of not storing the vaginal swabbings and the other evidence that they took at autopsy, was inadvertently destroyed, according to a prosecutor's report to us. But the semen spot on the panties was still available. All the evidence, this was in concert with the prosecution's office. We had wrote them a letter saying that this was what we wanted to do, take the test and send it off. Dr. Edward Blake, who did the test in California, came back with conclusive results that I was not the person who deposited semen and the individual who committed the crime.
You were released from prison June 28, 1993, 7 years ago.
Right.
When did the governor pardon you?
A year later, in 1994.
And the state awarded you $300,000?
Yes, which is nothing to me. I mean, it barely paid my father's and I bills as far as lawyers are concerned and private investigators and so forth. He spent his entire life savings. I had to pay him back. So it wasn't a lot. And I had been through literal hell. Innocent man. I'm a former Marine, honorably discharged. I've never been arrested for anything in my life, nothing. And for the people to elicit the fact that, or even to say that I could possibly even remotely think about hurting a child is so ludicrous, it's beyond me.
We're going to wrap up this segment right now, but a last comment on this day, which June 22nd, hours before Gary Graham is slated to die, 6 o'clock Texas time. Do you have any comment on that case?
Well, they should not execute Gary Graham. And I went down to Texas over a week ago to say that very fact. For the fact that an innocent person could die, and regardless of what, you know, we cannot kill innocent people in this country. Whether we want the death penalty or not, that fact remains to be seen. And with what I have seen of the case, Governor Bush, and with any sort of sense and spirit of life for the innocent ones on earth, should spare this man's life. And quite frankly, I think the death penalty should be banned in this country forever. Because when do we start living, getting above the criminal element and violence and that type of action in this country? If we perpetuate the same sort of violence in our actions as far as punishment, and I'm not saying to pat them on the hand and set them free. Of course not. We need to be stern in all our ways, but we should not kill our own citizens
Kirk
for the fact that innocent people might die.
Kirk Bloodsworth, I want to thank you for being with us, the first man who was exonerated by DNA evidence taken off death row, and now he is free. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! However you feel about the Gary Graham case, you can have a say in what happens to him by letting the governor and the parole board of Texas know. The governor's phone number, 512-463-2000, 512-463-2000, and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles is 512-406-5852. That's 512-406-5852. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an expose on what some are calling a UN terror squad in Kosovo. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This week in Kosovo, British-led peacekeepers announced they'd uncovered the largest cache of illegal weapons in the year since NATO forces entered Kosovo. A KFOR statement said the weapons were almost certainly entirely Albanian. KFOR forces found four massive underground bunkers in the village of Kleka, which is a former KLA stronghold west of the provincial capital, Pristina. According to KFOR, the weapons and equipment in the first two bunkers alone is large enough to fully outfit two heavy infantry companies, eliminate the entire population of Pristina, and destroy 900 to 1,000 tanks. These bunkers contain tripod-mounted heavy machine guns, hundreds of rifles, mortars, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, anti-tank and anti-personnel mines, flak jackets, large quantities of ammunition, and communications equipment. The weapons and ammunition were manufactured in a number of sources, including the United States, Albania, Yugoslavia, and China. This comes as attacks against Serbs and other minorities are intensifying in Kosovo. Today, we're going to look at the role the U.S. and U.N. have played in supporting terror in what is called the new Kosovo. Jeremy Scahill joins us now. He's currently the producer of Democracy Now! He reported from throughout Yugoslavia, including Kosovo, during and after the NATO bombing. And he's just written an article which will appear in the New Nation of the Nation magazine called... in the new issue of The Nation magazine called Cleansing Serbs in Kosovo. Jeremy, in your expose, you look at a U.S.-UN-funded agency called the Kosovo Protection Corps, or the KPC. Can you talk about the KPC and its role in what's happening right now in Kosovo?
Well, I think that the important thing for people to look at is exactly what the situation is right now in Kosovo. In the year since the U.S.-led NATO forces assumed control of the southern Yugoslav province, Kosovo has become a living hell for ethnic minorities, Serbs, Roma people, and other minorities. We have seen Serbian children gunned down in the last few weeks by drive-by shootings. Albanians have fired rocket grenades at UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner on Refugees, on buses that are repatriating Serbs. And attacks like this have caused the UNHCR and other agencies to say that it is unsafe to return Serbs and other minorities to their homes in Kosovo. And we're also seeing in tactics reminiscent of death squads of Central America throughout the 1980s that were backed by the United States, the Serbian Orthodox Church becoming a target of attacks. Just last night at midnight, six grenades went off at a monastery in Kosovo. This is just the latest in what have been a widespread series of attacks on the church. According to the Orthodox Church, more than 100 Orthodox churches and monasteries have been either damaged or destroyed since NATO came into the province. We've seen 14th century churches on the World Heritage List turned into 20th century rubble. Nuns have been molested. This is just one component of the terror in Kosovo. And the expose that I did is on an organization called the Kosovo Protection Corps. And what's interesting is that just a couple of weeks ago, on the eve of the anniversary of NATO's occupation of Kosovo, Secretary General Kofi Annan delivered a report to the UN Security Council in which he said that the attacks by Kosovo Albanians against Serbs and other minorities appear to be, quote, part of an orchestrated campaign. What's significant is that the Secretary General did not say who was orchestrating this campaign. Perhaps that was because to do that, to say who was orchestrating this campaign, making it possible, would be to implicate a UN-established, funded, and commanded force, this force called the Kosovo Protection Corps. Now, sometimes it's misidentified in the press as the police force of Kosovo. It's not the police force of Kosovo. On paper, it's slated as a, quote, civilian emergency service agency. It, in a lot of ways, resembles a fire department. They do things like clean up the roads, repair the roads. This is on paper. They even participate in the collection of garbage. They do demining activities. And according to its doctrine, which was written primarily by the United States, it is, quote, to have no role in defense, law enforcement, riot control, internal security, or any other task involved in maintenance of law and order. Well, the reality is that this Kosovo Protection Corps, consisting almost entirely of KLA members, has become a U.S. UN-funded 5,000-man terror squad in Kosovo, and the United States and the U.N. know it.
How do you know the U.N. knows it? How do you know the U.S. knows it?
Well, first of all, the United States and Germany are the two top funders of the Kosovo Protection Corps. In fact, they're almost the exclusive funders of it. The United States, to date, on paper, has given more than $5 million to the Kosovo Protection Corps. And, of course, the United States and Germany have been historically two of the strongest backers of the KLA. The reason that we know that the U.S. and U.N. know that they've been involved with a wider range of terror is because an internal U.N. report that was leaked to journalists earlier this year documents accusations that the Kosovo Protection Corps has been involved with, quote, criminal activities, killings, ill treatment, torture, illegal policing, abuse of authority, intimidation, breaches of political neutrality, and hate speech, end quote. All of this bankrolled by the United Nations, primarily the United States.
Have people been arrested?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I interviewed very recently Susan Manuel, who is the spokesperson in Kosovo for the UN mission there and the spokesperson for Bernard Kushner. And I asked her to respond to this report.
That report was an internal report that was pointing out some of the problems that will have to be disciplined. And there have been, since that report, there have been several KPC members who were fired or suspended, and also a discipline, very stringent discipline code was enacted.
Have any of the people, now in the report, it also details the making of death threats, for instance, to KFOR interpreters, demanding of protection contributions from ethnic minorities, kidnapping, in some cases murder. Has anyone been brought up on criminal charges in Kosovo from the KPC?
As far as I know, no one's been charged with anything yet. I know, as I said, people have been disciplined and there were some arrests, but I haven't seen any people actually charged in a court at this point.
That was Susan Manuel, the spokesperson for the United Nations mission in Kosovo. Exactly the number of people that have been suspended or fired is 13. 9 people are currently suspended. 4 were removed. And we're talking about very serious allegations here of murder, torture, kidnapping.
How many people are in the KCP, the KPC, the Kosovo Protection Corps?
The KPC is a force of 5,000-plus members. It consists of 3,000 active members and 2,000 of what they call reserve members, but there really is no difference between active and reserve.
And who heads it up?
The head of the Kosovo Protection Corps is a man by the name of General Agim Čeku. Prior to becoming the head of the Kosovo Protection Corps, he was the chief of military staff for the Kosovo Liberation Army. And prior to that, he was a general and brigadier general in the Croatian military. Agim Čeku is a man who was trained by an organization called Military Professional Resources Incorporated. This is a private paramilitary company in Alexandria, Virginia, that was founded in 1987 by former generals in the U.S. military and admirals, as well as NATO officials. Let me just tell you a couple of the people who were involved with founding this organization that then went on to train Agim Čeku. We have the former commanders-in-chief of the U.S. Army in Europe and the U.S. Central Command, the Supreme Allied Commander of the Atlantic Division, the former U.S. representative to the NATO Military Committee is on their board. So we're talking about people who were officially working for the Pentagon in Europe, some of them, of course, with NATO, in operations in the Balkans. They then become private citizens, they're in a corporation, and they then go on to train the Croatian army. There's no accountability for what exactly they did in their training of the Croatian army and General Čeku because they're a private corporation. You can't get documents on Military Professional Resources Incorporated by filing a Freedom of Information Act inquiry.
Yet the U.S. government will certify contracts with MPRI?
Yeah, MPRI has gotten contracts as high as $400 million, for instance, to do training and equipping programs in the Bosnian Federation. The Clinton administration in 1994 authorized a contract between MPRI and the Croatian government to train the Croatian military, of which Agim Čeku was a general. Shortly after MPRI arrived on the scene, its advisors are accused by Jane's Defense Weekly and other publications that follow military matters very closely of helping the Croatian military to plan what was known as Operation Storm. It was a 4-day blitzkrieg in 1995 in which more than 200,000 Serbs were expelled from their home in the Krajina region of Croatia. Agim Čeku was one of the key planners of that raid. He is suspected by the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia of committing war crimes, not just during Operation Storm, but also in raids he led on villages in 1993, where more than 150 civilians were massacred. He was the head of the 9th Brigade in the Croatian military, which was one of the most feared divisions of those forces. So this is a man with a history. The United States knows the history well because a U.S. corporation trained him. The U.S. knows him well because the U.S. military backed the Croatian army, and he was a general. And the U.S. was influential in putting him in a position of authority now in the new Kosovo.
Has the International War Crimes Tribunal charged him?
He's not been charged yet. The ICTY, as it's called, has been investigating Operation Storm for years. The New York Times called Operation Storm the single largest ethnic cleansing of the war. Recently, there were spokespeople who were quoted in the international press as saying that he is being investigated. At this point, there are no indictments that we know of. But the United States has said to, in a number of cases to reporters on the issue of Agim Čeku that if he were to be indicted, the indictment would be sealed and kept from public knowledge.
So this is the man who heads the KPC. You had an interesting story about a ceremony that for the latest inductees for the KPC.
Well, earlier this year, the UN mission in Kosovo held the ceremony in its headquarters in a town called Prizren in Kosovo, and they were swearing in 58 new members of this Kosovo Protection Corps. And the ceremony opened with an address by the UN administrator for that region. And as he was speaking, his remarks were being translated into both Serbo-Croatian and Albanian, in keeping with the on-paper goal of the UN that Kosovo is to remain a multi-ethnic society. Well, his remarks were interrupted by the cadets getting up off the stage and walking out of the auditorium in protest of the Serbian translation. They would only come back into the ceremony when they were assured by the UN that the ceremony would only continue in Albanian. the UN agreed to this, and the ceremony went on. Their action, according to the Kosovo Press Agency, which is basically the media arm of the KLA, said that this action was greeted with widespread applause in the audience. So this is the most minor of examples that you can give for the terror in Kosovo right now. This was documented in the report, the internal report I was referencing earlier, where they accused the KPC members of being involved with a number of crimes, including murder, torture, and kidnapping. This is documented because General Agim Čeku was the keynote speaker at this event. He gets up and he says after this walkout by the KPC cadets, quote, "Today you are becoming professional officers. Just as you knew how to triumph over all the obstacles and difficulties of war, this time, too, you will emerge victorious." Well, the UN report classified this as hate speech by Agim Čeku, and yet he continues to head this UN-funded agency that has essentially given the green light to the broader terror in Kosovo by not prosecuting members of the KPC who have committed murder, torture, kidnapping. The United States, in funding this and in not calling for prosecutions, in not removing Čeku, is giving the green light to the terror I spoke about earlier, the terror that has Serbian children being gunned down, that has Serbian Orthodox churches being razed to the ground, that has a general climate of horror in Kosovo.
What kind of uniforms does the KPC wear?
The KPC, this is actually an interesting story. The KPC has a logo on the side of their camouflage uniforms that are red and black. Red and black are the colors of the Kosovo Liberation Army flag and the Albanian flag. And
this is the UN force.
This is a UN force. In fact, it was General Wesley Clark, the U.S. General, who brokered that deal with the KLA. They wanted to have the eagle on it. The UN was saying, no, we're just going to have a map of Kosovo on it. Wesley Clark comes in, and he talks to the KLA, and they come out with an agreement that it's going to be red and black. So imagine if you're a Serbian person and you're living in a town and you see the KPC members come around to collect your garbage, so to speak, and you just look out the window, all you see is what appears to be a KLA armband.
Jamie Rubin also visited with them, didn't he?
Well, James Rubin was not just a spokesperson for the State Department in the discussions with the KLA last year. James Rubin was key to setting the policies that exist today. At every turn during the UN-NATO negotiations with the KLA, U.S. officials swooped in to change components of key documents to favor the KLA. This is one that James Rubin himself came in and changed. It was the document that was going to lay out the future of the KLA in Kosovo. It said, quote, this is James Rubin putting this in, quote, "Special consideration should be given to current KLA members to participate in the administration and police force of Kosovo in exchange for the help the KLA provided to NATO during its air campaign." Rubin said he had, quote, "made the deal in his capacity of advisor to Secretary of State Albright." The U.S. has been well aware of the history of the Kosovo Liberation Army. Robert Gelbard, who was the top U.S. envoy to the Balkans about a year and a half ago, said that, "I know terrorists when I see them. I used to be in charge of counterterrorism for the U.S. government. These guys are terrorists."
He's talking about the KLA.
And he's referring to the Kosovo Liberation Army. I know we only have a few moments left, Amy, but I want to say that as discussion goes on in Congress on the appropriations bill, I think what's important for people to look at is removing Agim Čeku from the Kosovo Protection Corps, prosecuting members of the KPC who commit crimes such as murder, extortion, kidnapping, etc. The United States should immediately cut all funding of the Kosovo Protection Corps until it is verified that they are no longer involved with these abuses.
Well, this is an explosive expose, and I want to thank you for it, Jeremy, and welcome back. The piece that he's written in this week's Nation magazine that's just come out is Cleansing Serbs in Kosovo. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by David Love, Jeremy Scahill, Anthony Sloan, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.